Caregivers, have you ever felt like nothing is going right? Well, cheer up and welcome to Dave, the Caregivers Caregiver Radio Program on Health Star Worldwide, where you'll learn how to avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout and how to survive the grieving process. They say that there are only three types of people in the world: those who are caregivers, those who will become caregivers, and those who will someday need a caregiver. Join Dave and his guests now and every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific on Health Star Worldwide as they share practice tips and tools that you can start using immediately to help get you through this day so you can live your caregiver life more fully and abundantly. Now, here's your caregiver host, Dave Nassani.
From Los Angeles, a big LA, welcome to all my listeners out there in Radio Land. I am Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver, coming to you live globally through the famous Health Star Worldwide Radio Network. Yes, folks, I am the guy who's going to help you and guide you through this very difficult journey called caregiving. And we are going to do our very best to help you avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout. Hey, we have an exciting show planned for you today. Let me see, who's going to be on? Well, along with my wonderful co-host, Adrian Gruberg, founder of the Caregiver Space, we are going to be interviewing Catherine Lee Scott, author of Last Dance at the Savoy. Isn't that a cool title? And she's also caregiver to her husband, and we will be discussing how to keep romance alive with your spouse. That is a very important topic because I am a spousal caregiver too, and I know that for a fact. Hey, if you're new to the show, we get many new listeners every week, especially now that we're on Blab. I am your host, Dave Nassani. This show is caregivers of every kind. And the one thing we know about caregivers is that they are caring, selfless, sacrificial. Oh, yeah, and that tiny little habit they have, they're very prone to burnout because they tend to put everyone else's needs above their own. Folks, come on, learn a lesson from the airlines. They tell you if the oxygen mask falls and it's an emergency, put your mask on first before you help your child with their mask. And, you know, they tell you that because they know you're going to burn out, blackout, actually, if you don't help, if you don't put your needs above the needs of your loved one. And we also talk about grief and loss here and the devastating effects it has on us. And it automatically throws us into this other thing called the grief process. Ouch. Unfortunately, folks, there is only one way out of the grief process, and that's to go through it. You can't go around it, can't go over it, can't go under it. Got to go through it. Sorry. Hopefully, we can help you through your grief and your loss if you happen to feel like you're stuck. All right, enough of all that. Catherine, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for agreeing to this interview today, and welcome to you too, Adrian.
Hi, Adrian and Dave. It's nice to be here. It's nice to know how to do this.
Yes. Catherine did not know anything about Blab, and we, for what seemed like 3 hours yesterday, got her up to speed on technology.
It was a 48-minute tutorial.
Well, and you got me like through it. 3 hours.
Thank you.
And she was very frustrated, but is it worth it now? I mean, now you can do it.
Yeah.
Just like a breeze with your eyes closed. And isn't this much nicer than staring at a wall talking to, you know, nobody?
Well, this is true.
Well, listen, I really appreciate you being so patient and kind and just coming on the show. Why don't you just take a minute or two and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm an author and an actress. And I mean, those are my lifelong career choices.
Hey, I'm impressed. Well,
I started as an actress, but I've always been a writer. So I've written a lot of books, and this was a book that I hadn't really thought I would write. Life, love, and caring for someone with progressive supranuclear palsy. But the someone, of course, was Jeff Miller, who is my husband. And he was the founding editor of Los Angeles Magazine, which was the very first city magazine in a major market in the country. He developed the template for the magazine when he was studying at UCLA doing graduate work. And he started the magazine right after he got his master's degree. And it was the first city magazine in the country 8 years before New York Magazine, which I always love to say. I know he would appreciate my saying that.
He sounds like a very smart person.
He was also a very funny man and a man that he was very social and he really enjoyed people. And I think he developed the idea for a city-centric magazine because he loved literature, but he also really loved Los Angeles, where he was born and raised, and the whole California coast. And I think that all came into the magazine. But it happened some years after he retired from the magazine that this man who had been an editor and a publisher and a writer was no longer able to even grasp a pencil or release it, wasn't able to read, couldn't turn the pages of a book. And as we led up to the diagnosis of PSP, I mean, we did know that something was wrong, but it's very hard to diagnose this disease. So it's a disease without treatment. There is no cure. So what I really respected about Jeff is that he wanted to live life fully, even though, you know, he was living with a terminal disease. And so, you know, we had a wonderful romance. The book that I've written, Life, Love, and Caring for Someone, is really as much about life and love as it is caregiving, because it's such an important part of it. And Dr. Yvette Bordelon, who is in the Movement Disorder Clinic at UCLA and who is one of Jeff's doctors and enrolled him in drug trials and an environmental study, always talks about hope being such a very important part of both caregiving and for somebody who's living with a disease like that.
Well, I want to separate life before and life after, because things change so dramatically. But first, let me take this opportunity to apologize for my rudeness for sitting there and ignoring Blade down there. Blade, say hello.
Hi.
And tell us who you are and what you do. Why are you on our show, Blade?
Because I'm your producer and you need me. That's why I'm on your show.
Blade, we cannot hear you. I think you're muted. Oh, wait a minute. I muted you. Okay,
you're okay.
Go ahead.
You muted me.
Go ahead.
See, I'm your producer and you can't do the show without me, so that's why I'm here.
Blade, I don't know if you're doing that on purpose, but you sound like Donald Duck.
That's what I said.
Like Donald Duck?
Okay, we're muting you. Well, Blade is our engineer, and he normally doesn't sound like that. He normally sounds like a normal person. I don't know if he swallowed too much helium this morning for breakfast or what.
I sound like Donald Duck.
Back to you, Catherine. So how many years were you married before?
Well, I met Jeff in 1968. A long, long time ago, I was doing a television series called look at that. You're going to have to count on your fingers and toes.
15 years? Were you married more than me? Really?
No, we weren't married that whole time. But I met him. I met him in 1968. I was doing a television series called Dark Shadows. Mm. And I played Maggie Evans and Josette Dupre on this paranormal gothic romance with the vampire Barnabas Collins. And I went to a party, when all of the political campaigns were happening, and Jeff happened to turn up at this party with Tom Wolfe, and I had just read Tom Wolfe's book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, and I started talking to these two guys, and I really warmed to Jeff. I mean, I liked Tom Wolfe as well, but.
So it was
I
love
really
at first
warmed.
Sight. Apparently.
Oh, it was very much.
There was electricity.
Way.
There was connection. Yeah. There was fireworks. Yeah. All of the above.
But as they say, we were geographically undesirable because I was doing my television series live in New York, and Jeff had started Los Angeles Magazine, of course, in Los Angeles. So the romance got off to a very, very slow start. As a matter of fact, we both married other people. And
really?
I lived in Paris and London for many years. And he married Barbara, who was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis a few weeks after they were married. And she never went into remission, and she passed away after 12 years. So we sort of kept in touch because we had a lot of people in common. But I mentioned this about multiple sclerosis because he was her caregiver for 12 years while running the magazine, which was newly launched. And he would take care of her the whole weekends and then in the evenings, and he had somebody come in during the day. But he really knew what caregiving was all about. We certainly figured into our story later.
There's only three kinds of people in the world: those who are caregivers, those who are going to become caregivers, and those who are going to need a caregiver.
That's right.
You guys have done all three.
Yes. And when Jeff and I got together again, it was in 1988. My marriage was sort of falling apart. Interestingly enough, my former husband and Jeff, I mean, we became very close friends. So I know I always worried about those conversations when they got together, you know, can't live without her, can't live with her kind of thing. But they got on terribly well. And actually, my former husband was just terrific in kind of helping me out with Jeff a few times. So when we got together...
I'm sorry for interrupting. I just want to take this one step at a time here. When the romance started to evolve with you and Jeff, was he ill yet? Was he beginning to get ill? Or how much time did you have before his illness and afterwards?
Well, we got together again in 1988 when one of his editors chose a book that I had written as one of the Christmas gift selections, and we had lunch together. And he wasn't at all symptomatic then. I mean, he was fine. But when I look back now, or when I was writing the book, and I look back, there were certain behavioral things that just seemed a bit eccentric, just little things. Mm-hmm. But with hindsight, of course, I realized it was probably the very earliest signs that he had a neurological condition. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't just happen overnight. Mm-hmm. So early on, you know, there were just little signs.
When did you discover there was a big problem?
Well, we married in 1991, and I would say probably 2005. So it was a good number of years and the hallmarks of progressive supranuclear palsy. And by the way, a little bit about this disease. It's one of five what they call prime of life diseases. And one of them, Lewy body with dementia, is what Robin Williams was diagnosed with. And Dudley Moore and Richard Rainwater both died of PSP, which is what Jeff had. There's also corticobasal degeneration and multiple systems atrophy. And they're all neurological diseases with their own little, you know, pluses, differences. But they're all part of this family of diseases. And the hallmark of the disease that Jeff had is that you fall down and always backward. Another sign is that you can't shift your gaze up and down, which meant that, of course, he would have difficulty reading. But among the very earliest signs, when we were driving somewhere and I saw something out the side of the car and I would draw Jeff's attention to it, he'd just get very, very irritable and say, "I'm driving, I can't look." The point is, though, he couldn't. Yeah. He couldn't. And he would walk with his eyes down. I didn't realize it until many years later that he was walking with his eyes down because he couldn't shift them back and forth. So there were a lot of things, and there were behavioral changes.
Tell us, Catherine, the moment that you first realized that you were going to move from this relationship of the loving wife to the expedient caregiver.
Oh, well,
remember,
that happened.
Remember when that happened?
Oh, absolutely. I was in a doctor's office, and he just finished examining Jeff. He didn't know if he had Parkinson's or whatever he had, but then he handed me a flyer for the for a support group, and there were all of these diseases on it: CBD, MSA, PSP, whatnot. And I said, "You think that Jeff has one of these?" And he said, "I'm almost sure of it." He said, "You're going to need home care, and I would suggest you go to this support group and find out all you can." And as soon as I got home, of course, I looked up these diseases on the internet, and then I realized what we had in store for ourselves. And interestingly, I think that Jeff had a better idea sooner than I did, because as soon as Jeff heard that it was a neurological disease, he immediately you know, thought about his first wife and multiple sclerosis. So he knew.
And how did it affect your love? How did it affect the relationship?
Well, here's an this is an odd thing. We then went to the Mayo Clinic because we really wanted a definitive diagnosis. And we were told that we would probably be there for a day or two. We were actually there with Jeff being examined for only 2 hours. Hmm. And the neurologist immediately said, well, it is either CBD or PSP. But we walked out of there lighthearted. That sounds odd, but, you know, all around us, there were people, you know, who were showing signs of treatment for cancer, all kinds of other diseases, all of which, you know, had the hope of a cure or treatment. Being told that you have a disease for which there is no treatment or cure suddenly takes a kind of burden off your shoulders.
Yeah, just knowing what it is.
Just knowing what it is, and also knowing that, you know, you can live with the, as Jeff would say, the bliss of denial. I mean, he just kind of ignored it because there wasn't anything he could do anyway. I couldn't actually afford that kind of denial. And I had to find out a lot about these diseases because it was clear that, you know, there was progression. Wow. So initially, we did have a very romantic lifestyle, if you will. We did a lot of traveling, and we loved doing dinner parties and that sort of thing. And life went on, and you know, we did keep the romance in our lives. I think something that I really wanted to address in the book, because it always comes up in the support groups that I've attended, and now I'm leading support groups. Wow. It always comes up, the idea of how do you keep romance in a relationship? Because there is going to be role reversal.
Yeah.
When I cared for my mother, you know, the woman who had taken care of me was now looking to me to take care of her. That kind of role reversal was not easy for her. Maybe for me a little bit easier, but for her, very difficult. And for Jeff, who is a commanding sort of presence, he was a big man. He, you know, for him, at over 6 feet tall, to be depending upon a 5'7" woman who maybe 80 pounds lighter, supporting him when he walked, helping him, you know, with eating and everything else, that was a difficult thing to accept. So, I do say in the book that it does happen that men do fall in love with their nurses. The opposite happens. The opposite happens with a caregiver because it is role reversal in most cases, and it's a difficult thing to deal with.
Before you save all that, we're going to take a break and we'll come back with a fresh amount of energy in new questions. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Caregivers, have you ever felt like nothing is going right? Well, cheer up and tune in to Dave, the Caregivers Caregiver Radio Program on HealthStar Worldwide, where you'll learn how to avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout and how to survive the grieving process. With roughly 100 million caregivers in the U.S. and Canada alone, it's about one-third of the population. That means everybody probably knows somebody caring for a loved one. They say that there are only three types of people in the world: those who are caregivers, those who will become caregivers, and those who will someday need a caregiver. Mothers of special needs children, family members caring for elderly parents, spouses, siblings, or friends caring for disabilities such as Alzheimer's, dementia, cancer, stroke, heart disease, diabetes, muscular dystrophy, AIDS, autoimmune diseases. The list goes on. Join Dave and his guests every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific on HealthStar Worldwide as they discuss avoiding caregiver burnout and surviving grief. You'll start feeling better in no time as you begin to receive practical tips and tools that you can start using immediately to help you get through the day and to live life more fully and abundantly.
And we're back. with Adrian Gruberg and Catherine Lee Cutter, right?
Scott.
I'm so sorry. I cruised my name. I got to have them right in front of me. You know, ever since I turned 50, it's like my RAM just got really small. Anyway, Adrian, you wanted to ask Catherine some questions. Go right ahead.
Yes. When I took care of Steve, there were two sides to this. I was the only one he really trusted. On the other hand, there was always fear on his part, so he wasn't 100% sure if he could trust me. So there was this very strange conundrum. Did your husband just totally trust you in this?
You know, I think he did. When I attended that first support group meeting, and I didn't handle it very well, I have to say. I mean, I literally broke down because I was seeing people in a more advanced condition than he was, and it was very difficult. But when I came home, I tried to hide all of that. I think he sensed that it had been a difficult session. And I remember he sat down in the armchair in my office, and he just said, you know, I really appreciate that you're learning all about this disease, but please don't tell me, and let's not tell other people for a while, because he said, I don't think people can tell. He wasn't aware that people could see that he was having difficulty walking. And people would call me the day after a dinner party, and they would say, is Jeff okay? And so I was in a position of really not wanting to betray my promise to my husband.
Right.
And I think that he sometimes wondered if I might be saying things behind his back. I assured him that I wasn't, and I was really careful about that because I realized that how important trust was going to be, especially down the road. But I think if that's what you're referring to, there was that moment.
That moment came and went with the two of us. He didn't want me to tell anyone, and I didn't. He had a show that he had done on cable television for 35 years, and he never looked sick. So for that 1 hour a week that he did this call-in show, he was not sick.
Yeah,
because nobody knew it. I certainly kept that confidence. But it was, you know, the medications got more and more complicated, and as the condition progressed, he learned to know that I was a lot smarter than he thought I was, and he already thought I was smart. But he was fearful. He was just genuinely fearful. So it was hard to trust anyone. And I was in that category as much as anyone else. He trusted me implicitly, but he didn't trust me at all.
Dear. I don't think that I had to deal with that as much. There was there came the time when we brought in home hospice. And I think that that's another issue that people really don't understand. Home hospice is revelatory. These are wonderful people. And you get, you know, bathing help and a doctor coming in once a month. You have nurses checking. It's really wonderful. And it doesn't mean end of life. It means quality of life. Right. And if people can understand that, I think that when Jeff first heard the word hospice, there was a moment where, you know, his eyes met mine,
right,
and we knew that we had turned a very big corner, in fact, the big corner. But interestingly enough, I think because he had cared for Barbara with MS, he very often was the one who initiated the change in our care. For example, he was the one who asked for a hospital bed. He was the one who said that he probably needed a wheelchair. So I think I benefited in a way from the fact that he had been a caregiver himself. I don't think the trust issue was that great. One thing I did want to mention is that one of Jeff's earliest doctors, and this is something I really recommend to anybody when I'm leading one of these support groups, this doctor recommended that I keep a daily journal. And I told him that as a writer, I was already doing that. And he said, but no, keep a very, very careful record of the progression, because when you're dealing as a caregiver with somebody who has a disease for which there is no treatment, we're going to be prescribing a lot of medications off-label, meaning that Jeff was taking medications for everything from Alzheimer's, which he didn't have, to restless leg syndrome, to gout, I don't know. But we were being given these medications in the hope that maybe one of them might have an ingredient that might help him. He didn't have Parkinson's, but he took Sinemet. So I did keep a very close record. And one of the reasons I was able to write the book is that I had the template on my desk.
Yeah.
I had this daily journal. Now, the thing that I wanted to mention is that it happened one day that I was looking back to see when Jeff had started taking mirtazapine. And what I noticed in the journal is that I was keeping a very good record of the progression of his disease, but what I was leaving out were the things that were happening between us and the way I was feeling. I was essentially lying to my own journal because of what Jeff was going through. Did I really want to write down?
Becomes readable.
Yeah. Did I really want to write down what sounded like complaints and self-pity and bleh, all kinds of feelings of impatience and whatnot? Did I really want to own up to that when Jeff was dealing with what he was dealing with? And it was a wake-up call. I changed quite a bit after that because I realized that I was in a kind of denial myself. And as a caregiver, I don't think you can afford to do that.
Now, one of the things that I stress on my site is the importance of keeping the journal. And there's event space. There's a space for people to just come and complain and moan and, you know, just let it all out, because
vent.
Safe place. It's a private place.
Yes.
And there's no place else to put it except in your journal. If you're not in denial.
Well, I agree.
Sometimes that'll just hit you. I was in support groups and was learning as I went along what to expect. So I was relatively prepared for the progression of things that happen. But I would get really angry because I was also taking care of Steve's mother, who had come to live with us 2 years after he was diagnosed. She was diagnosed with lymphoma at the age of 89.
How did you do all of that?
I did it. And
superwoman.
And she, I never got angry at her, but outwardly. But inwardly, she was robbing me of the one or two good years that I had, that I was going to have with him.
Right.
And so I had a place that I could put that on paper.
Yeah. Well, when I realized, you know, because I obviously had to pull back from acting and from publishing. I was still writing because I could sit with my laptop next to him. Mm-hmm. Because he really wanted me nearby, and he wanted that companionship. That companionship is one of the ways in which we really did keep what attracted us to each other in the first place alive. I mean, it was lovely to be able to read to him and to see the expressions on his face when, of course, he was no longer able to speak. How he communicated. You know, it, it, and it, it was a very important time. I think that if I had made that discovery of what I was doing in that journal, I would not have been as aware as I needed to be of the emotional ties that we had to keep going. It's you know, you can't just be a caregiver who hands out the medication and helps with the bathing and all of that sort of thing. It's the real thing that you have to do as a caregiver is to be there and to be present,
right?
And to keep that emotional connection together. I think I was able to do that later.
I'm curious. You know, love has many different definitions. You know, we go in the beginning of a relationship, and our love is, you know, sexual and emotional and touchy-feely. And as we get older, you know, it just naturally turns into a different form of love. How would you say your love changed? Because both is definitions of love, the former and the latter. Explain the differences and what your love in the beginning transgressed into.
Well, there was always terrific intimacy and real affection between us. And interestingly enough, even when that hospital bed arrived in our lives, and Jeff had asked for it because it made him more comfortable because, you know, all of the tricks that bed could do up and down. So he needed that because... And it also came with this kind of contraption to prevent bed sores and whatnot, this kind of thing that had its own kind of wheezed because air went in and out of it, which he found terribly funny. So did I. But here's the thing. I would climb into that hospital bed and spend the night with him. And there was always a sense of a physical connection between us. There was always a kind of intimacy right up until the end when he passed away in my arms. And the title for the book, Last Dance at the Savoy, as I was holding him in my arms with Cole Porter and Artie Shaw playing, it was as though we were dancing. So that it really was romantic. It was intimate. It was, how did it change? It became deeper. I can't think of another word for it, but the kind of intimacy and love that we had for each other really deepened. It communicated itself in different ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, just a touch on his cheek, was very intimate.
Catherine, is there any hope for those? Adrian and I speak to people all the time, caregivers or spousal caregivers, and their relationship has just degraded to zero. I mean, there's no appreciation. There's no respect and courtesy, and there's resentments. And is there hope for a couple that used to have that love and that has regressed down to zero? What advice would you give people to try to pick up the pieces and to bring hope back that even in the midst of a debilitating relationship, that there can still be love, there can still be romance, there can still be hope?
This came up in a support group that I led in San Francisco just 3 weeks ago. And it was a man that brought it up, who really loved his wife, and he just said, you know, he was talking about the kinds of feelings of resentment and impatience and so on that were, and that is what was robbing them of that that real connection. And it's to take some time to yourself. But it's also to just sit there and be next to somebody, hold their hand, and try to connect to what first drew you to that person in the first place. It's showing decency and respect for each other. if that's been lost before somebody got ill, it's very hard to get it back again, but I think that it can be. Is that a doorbell dog? And
not my doorbell.
My doorbell, her dog.
But, you know, the other thing that I talked about in that support group is how important a sense of humor is, because a sense of humor can lead you back into that kind of connection so much easier in a way than just sitting and trying to talk your way into something. Trying to bring some kind of fun thing, back into your life. I'll tell you what we did. I put a little round table with a cloth and two chairs in our bedroom. I got rid of everything that looked like there was an invalid there. All of the medications I put in a separate room. And I turned our bedroom, which is fortunately a fairly large bedroom, into a cocktail lounge. And from 5 to 7 every day, our friends knew that they could come over and have a Sam Adams, a martini, a glass of wine. Some cake, tea, whatever. But for 2 hours, Jeff was at his best. He looked forward to it. It made us a couple again. It made us social. It meant that I could leave people who really wanted to spend some private time with Jeff sitting there with a glass of wine in a very comfortable way. And in a way, that also induced that kind of that sense of romance and that there was fun, that there was fun to life.
Mm-hmm. You're so clever, Catherine. It's an excellent idea.
Oh, people should be taking notes. I think it's just that I wanted a glass of wine at the end of the day. And but you know, here's the thing. Here's the thing that comes up all the time in these support groups. And that is that caregiving is a very isolating thing. And when you lose, when the patient loses the ability to speak, to communicate, when they're simply not looking like they once did. I mean, Jeff's colleagues were coming to visit him and they were no longer seeing the very vital guy who had been their boss. So in creating that sort of cocktail lounge atmosphere, I mean, I just turned the lights down low. I put on some jazz. Mm-hmm. And there was no sign that there was an invalid there, except that he was, you know, sitting in a reclining chair and couldn't really speak, but you still had the sense that it was a social occasion. And those 2 hours a day made all the difference.
Yeah, and that wouldn't have happened unless you got out of the denial. And then that opened up a whole new door, and then you embraced the new normal.
I keep using the new normal all the way through Last Dance at the Savoy. And by the way, I will tell you a funny story.
Save it for after the break. We're going to take a short break.
Oh, because this is a good story.
Good. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
One arm, one leg, 100 words. Overcoming unbelievable hardships is a touching story about Charlene, a stroke survivor. Back in 1996, Charlene was a healthy, normal, very active 52-year-old woman whose amazing talents resembled that of both a Martha Stewart and Wonder Woman. But all that changed when she suffered a massive stroke that left her severely speech impaired and paralyzed on her right side. She met her husband Dave 21 years earlier. They had a wonderful fairy tale storybook-like courtship that soon culminated in their marriage. Charlene had just come out of a marriage where after 10 years, she received two black eyes and a broken nose by her former husband when he came home high on speed. Charlene believed in no second chances of any kind for abuse, so she left. Finding herself all alone in the world with her 5 and 10-year-old daughters, Cynthia Lorraine and Deborah Lynn, she started raising them by herself for the next 2 years. Then fate brought them all together. After falling in love with Charlene, Cindy, and Debbie, their love then produced Rebecca. They all had a wonderful, normal life for the next 20 years. But today, things are very different for everyone. One arm, one leg, 100 words. Overcoming unbelievable hardships is the amazing story of a woman's fight to survive. To survive all that life had thrown her way. Everyone who knows Charlene is thoroughly amazed at how she lives day by day, month by month, year by year, and with a smile on her face and hope in her heart that everything is going to be okay. Her faith in God is her foundation in this hope that everything happens for a reason and what doesn't kill her will make her stronger. She inspires everyone that meets her. Best-selling author Lynn Barrington says, "If you think you have it bad, read this book. This is a beautiful, genuine story from the heart. It is inspiring and easy to read. When you finish this book, you'll be able to look at your concerns in a new light." 9-time Grammy and Dove Award recipient, the godfather of contemporary gospel music, Andre Crouch, says, "Charlene just won't let the promises of God go, and she has not let her circumstances get in the way of her faith. She's not just a survivor, she's more than a conqueror." As the Bible states, you will be encouraged by her testimony, regardless of what you're going through. Order your copy today from the author's website, onearmoneleg100words.com. And Dave and Charlene will personally autograph your copy. Enjoy.
And we're back with Catherine Lee Scott, author, actress, caregiver, and all-around amazing woman. Adrian had to leave and go to an appointment, but I wrote her address, the website address, Catherine, on the area on the right there, which will take you there. And you can contact her. I can give you her phone number as well. So tell us your story, your funny story.
Well, the funny story is that Princess Di used to visit Jeff all the time.
She used to visit who?
My husband. She used to visit Jeff. All the time.
My wife would be envious.
Well, here's the situation. She had already passed away, and I never saw her spectral visits because I was always in the kitchen or somewhere else. And I realized, of course, that Jeff wanted companionship. And you remember when? And I really think that because he would say Princess Di came by, it gave her a cosmopolitan, and he would be funny about it. And then, of course, I started thinking about it. You remember when Princess Di always used to say that her marriage was crowded because of Camilla? And I remember thinking to myself, do I really want my marriage crowded with Princess Di? But she used to come and visit, apparently, when I wasn't giving Jeff enough attention. If I spent too much time in my office writing or editing something, he'd let me know that Princess Di had come to visit.
That's funny.
Yeah, it is funny. But, I mean, he really had such affection for her. And I remember we stayed up late watching her funeral and on television. And one thing that he did lament is that they did not play Ravel's The Von Fur Princess at her funeral. So he insisted that for his funeral we play Ravel's The Von Fur Princess.
Wow. So let's talk about the role reversal again. How did that really affect you, you know, when he became more vulnerable and more dependent upon you? Did you start feeling like a mother instead of a wife?
Yeah, that can happen because it's not even so much that you start feeling like a mother. You start feeling like the dreaded hall monitor or the nanny from hell. Because you're the one who's pulling the peanuts away from him because you know he'll choke on it.
You're
the one who's, you know, who's having to put restrictions. Another one of the hallmarks of the disease is impulsive behavior. And he would try to get up from a chair and walk, which of course meant that he would fall. So all of the things that I did, I even stacked pillows around him. I did all kinds of things. I mean, my book is full of little things that one has to do when you're caregiving, just to protect yourself and him. So yeah, it became a very difficult situation when he really, I think, you know, sort of resented it when he gave up his car and when he turned in his car keys. But he still wanted, of course, to see his friends for lunch. And I would have to come up with excuses for dropping him off and picking him up because he didn't want his friends to know that, you know, he couldn't drive. Mm. I mean, there is, that's the kind of role reversal I think we're talking about. Jeff always did most of the driving. Suddenly I was doing all of it. He used to love to go to the jazz festival in Monterey. And of course, he enjoyed going for those 3 days on his own. Well, I had to drive him to the Monterey Jazz Festival. And then Divine, when he, you know, wanted me around, and when he really wanted to just sit by himself and listen to the music. But he needed assistance walking by then. So again, knowing when somebody wants assistance and when they want to be left alone has a lot to do with ameliorating the problems of role reversal, I think.
Yeah. What tips could you give those people who just aren't handling it very well?
Well, oh, it's hard because one of the things that happens when somebody starts having difficulty speaking is that you jump in and answer for them. And I would just virtually bite my tongue when people came to visit, and I would let the lull happen rather than jump in and keep a conversation rolling. I would just let the lull happen until he could get the words together and he could say them himself. I can't tell you how much tension that lifted, just that alone.
Yeah. You know, I've learned that with my wife as well. She lost her speech in a stroke 20 years ago, and she severely speech impaired. Maybe she knows about half a dozen words that she can bring into her memory because she has aphasia, can't remember how to form the words, etc. But when people, when she talks to people, she's very, very communicative and very descriptive, very good with gestures and tonality and touching, and she's a great communicator. And she's always going out trying to start these great conversations with people that, you know, I say, can she finish it? Because the people will invariably look at me like, okay, what's she saying? And I was like, well, I don't know. Just keep, you know, asking questions and she can say yes or no. And it's basically like a game of charades. Did you find that basically you were playing charades and Pictionary and all of those things?
All of that. But one other thing that I happened when Jeff really started losing his voice, I got him one of those amplifiers, the kind of thing that, you know, dance instructors use. Or you find in health clubs, and it had the little spongy microphone in front, and it was a headband, and Jeff called it his Madonna. But you know that gave him the ability to be heard. It amplified his voice, and he gained strength from it. So when people came to visit, suddenly he was part of the conversation again. So again, there are a lot of little things. If you see the problem and you can visualize the fix, you can usually find something that'll accommodate. And we kept doing that the whole time.
Here's an important question. Many people have faith. Their faith either increases or decreases. They either become bitter or better. Some of these issues, like why do bad things happen to good people, you know, I don't think we'll ever know the answer to that. What has this done to your faith and the whole caregiving experience, are you grateful for the whole experience? Do you wish it never happened? If you had to do it over again, you would have picked someone else to get married. I mean, what have you learned from this entire global picture of now that you're 5 years after his death?
Well,
and you've had time to think about all of this and kind of like the Wizard of Oz moment. So what have you learned, Dorothy?
Well, I'm a quick person. I do everything too quickly. And I learned patience. I learned to slow myself down. But I also know that I married the right man. And when caregivers say that it's a privilege to care for somebody, it really is, because it gives you the opportunity of really demonstrating, actively showing your affection and your care and your love. Mm-hmm. So that was really a very good part of it. In terms of faith, I probably had a deeper faith than my husband did. But it took the form of just knowing that there was some kind of higher being, that there was some, that I wasn't just living in chaos, put it that way. I don't know how else to explain that.
Do you feel like you had some spiritual help and inner strength that you couldn't have made it without that?
For me, very much so. I don't think that applied to my husband, but for me, it really did. So that there was, I did draw some strength from that. And among the many things that I didn't give up, I gave up so many things during that period of time, but I didn't give up. I belonged to the homeless program at the church. I continued doing that as long as I could. And also a couple of study groups, which gave me an outlet for an hour. And I had somebody stay with Jeff when I went, but it also gave me a time of reflection, which is terribly important. You can't just keep going. You really do need that time for reflection and contemplation so that you actually see what's happening. Otherwise, it just goes in a blur.
Well, I can't believe this hour has gone by so quickly. Why don't you tell us how someone can get a hold of you if they want to learn more, if they want to buy your book? You have a website.
I hope they want to buy my book.
Actually,
it's a very funny book, because if you don't have a sense of humor, caregiving is really tough. So the book is actually very funny because I tend to write funny. You can go on Amazon.com and you can get a discount, for heaven's sake, on the retail price if you go on Amazon. And it's Last Dance at the Savoy. And it's available in an ebook and in a print edition. And very soon it'll be available for an MP3 download. So it's available now. And you can also go to my website, which is www.katherineleescott.com. And if you want to reach me, katherineleescott.com. And you can also reach me with CumberlandPressBooks.com or at gmail.com, CumberlandPressBooks@gmail.com, if you want to send an email.
Wow. And you mentioned you've been writing for a long time. How many other books have you written?
I've written a couple of books on film art, lobby cards, two of those, classic films and classic comedies. Uh-huh. I wrote a book called The Bunny Years, about the 25-year history of the Playboy Clubs, told through the experiences of the women who worked as bunnies.
Which you were not one, I assume?
Oh, I was a bun. I was a bunny in New York when the club first opened.
Really?
And one of my closest friends, Susan Sullivan, who's on Castle now and was so wonderful all through my caregiving with Jeff. We met as bunnies. And so Debbie Harry was a bunny. Anyway, they're all in my book. And that's a fun book. And then I've written several murder mysteries, the Jinx Fogarty murders, murder mysteries, Down and Out in Beverly Hills, Jinxed. And then there's Dark Passages, a paranormal thriller. And I've just finished writing a book called September Girl, which is mainstream women's fiction. And then I've written a lot of books on classic television. And of course, I've written about Dark Shadows. And I also write magazine articles. I wrote a long piece for Opera News during the time that my husband was so ill. And I talk about it in the book.
Awesome. Wow, too many to count. And for those of you, Adrienne has left us, and she's the caregiverspace.org. And go on there and you go into her chat rooms, etc. And my website, caregiverscaregiver.com. Thank you again, everybody, for coming. Thank you, Katherine, so much for this interview. I had so much fun.
Thank you.
And, so impressed with your story.
God bless. Thank you, Dave. I'm impressed with you, I have to say, and Adrienne. Well, but,
I'm
so glad you're doing this.
Thank you. Mutual Admiration Society here.
Nice
and
to
Blade,
meet you.
Blade, thank you for what you do, even though we couldn't hear you, except like Donald Duck. And we'll fix that. Everybody, have a nice day, and we will see you next Tuesday at noon Pacific time. And all of these podcasts are recorded on my website. So anytime, 24/7. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Caregivers Caregiver Radio Program with Dave Nassani. Join Dave each Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, or catch the program anytime, 24/7, right here on HealthStar Worldwide.